ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Well, landing on my desk the other day is a monumental publication, a history of Australian winemaking. It's called The Australian Ark, as in Noah's Ark. The story of Australian wine, 1788 to the modern era. It's been written and produced by Andrew Kayard, who's a master of wine. That's an extraordinarily difficult qualification to achieve. A wine auctioneer expert and writer who is the full bottle on all of these matters. Pardon the pun. The book was recently launched and the reaction from the wine industry has been unanimous. Phenomenal achievement, incredible legacy, magisterial work. It is quite something. It's not the sort of book that gets published anymore. It's sumptuously produced with heaps of colour photographs on high quality paper and so on. A treat to have, handle and read, and also, I'm sure, a proud thing to have given birth to. Andrew Kayard's in the studio with us this evening. Andrew, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip.
You must feel proud of it.
Yeah, no, it's great to have it completed, but it's been such a long journey. It's very difficult to get any perspective on it, but it's wonderful to have
There's never been a book like this really written, has there? I mean, there have been histories of Australian wine, I suppose. There have been single-volume things.
There's been a few. A guy called John Beeston, who's no longer with us, wrote a concise history of Australian wine, and a very good writer called Max Allen did a modern history. And of course, James Halliday's done a lot of individual histories, but there's never been a history that goes from the very beginning to the present day. Yeah. So it's the first time.
I said at the beginning it was something we ought to be proud of. I mean, without being tub-thumpingly, you know, patriotic, it actually is. It's an Australian success story, isn't it? Because it needn't have been successful, but it was.
The Australian wine industry, absolutely. Mm. And the visions for it were just absolutely enormous. And we always think of Australian wine being born out of a fortified wine culture, which is just simply not true. You know, the observers of the 19th century believed that Australia would become the France of the Southern Hemisphere. And, you know, those kind of ambitions have kind of carried through post-war, and we're really making some of the finest wines in our history right now.
Mm. Are we uniquely placed to make wine? I mean, Australia's a big country. There's all sorts of climates in Australia.
Yeah, there
you know, are. from the very far tropics, of course, to the deepest freezes of, you know, Cygnet in southern Tasmania. Are we uniquely placed, or is it just that we're a big enough country and there are pockets of it where the grapes do well?
Well, we are uniquely placed, but if you look at the story of wine, you know, vineyards were really established where the first settlements were. Mm. And so it was really a convenience rather than anything else. So the Hunter Valley, for instance, would be considered by many people as not being the ideal place to grow grapes, but it's landed up having its own unique identity.
Why is that? Why on earth is the Hunter Valley, which when you go there, because I think a lot of people expect, you know, magnificently verdant rolling hills. It's not like that at all.
Well, it really depends on what time of the year you go, but it's quite a humid climate up there, almost subtropical, really. Mm. I mean, it's the moderating breezes that come in from the ocean that kind of cool it down. But it's become really, you know, particularly famous for Semillon. And the first vine cuttings of Semillon were planted there in the 1820s, and we still have the same genetic vine stock that was first planted in the 1820s, and that same material is being used to make wine today. And I think that's just extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. Mm. Let's go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
I love this little detail in the book. It might have been by Geoffrey Robertson, I think, actually, who asserts, I don't think I've read this before, that when Governor Phillip arrives in Botany Bay, not Cook, but when Phillip arrives in Botany Bay, and famously, as we know, when Phillip arrives in Botany Bay, he's been told there to go there by Cook and Banks, you know, all those years before, 18 years before. He turns up in Botany Bay and pretty much immediately realises it's not suitable at all for a harbour or a settlement, and they figure out what to do, and of course they go north and eventually find, fortunately for them, something which Cook never saw, which was the great port of Port Jackson, and then the settlement takes place there. But when Phillip arrives, he is met by a group of Aboriginal people who think, "What the hell is going on here?" It said that he offered them a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Did
and then they, spat it out.
He offered them a glass of wine. I don't think I've read that. What would he have offered them?
Oh, it would have been something they'd probably picked up along the way. Probably it was something from the Cape Colony, or even it could have been French wine, but it's probably more likely Cape Colony wine, or from Madeira, or somewhere like this.
So it was here from the beginning, in a way, if you want to.
But you know, Captain Arthur Phillip was of German origin. Did you know that? And which is I find absolutely fascinating that. You know, and he was really a kind of covert operative. He was a really, really interesting character.
You don't shy away in your book from what, of course, happened as a result of Aboriginal dispossession either. I mean, that's part of the story of Australia as well.
Yeah, it's a very, very sad story. And you know, I mean, this whole book is the history of Australia through the prism of wine and viticulture.
Very much so.
And so as a consequence to that, you can't just kind of divorce the plight of First Nations people from the story. And there's some really, really tragic, you know, stories. I mean, I don't dwell on it overly, but at the same time, I don't shy away from it at all.
No, that's true. Well, why did wine begin, Andrew? It didn't need to begin, did it? The currency of the early colony was rum, as we know, the Rum Rebellion, and surely high punch distilled spirits were likely to be more valuable than bottles of wine.
Yes, but the government was also extremely worried about the problem with rum and the degree of intoxication within the community.
And rum wasn't made here. All the rum was imported, wasn't it?
A lot of it was imported. Yes. Yeah. So in the end, you know, they did encourage vineyards to be planted. And so the first vineyards were planted almost immediately.
Really?
After settlement in 1788.
I read in your book that 1790 is the first Australian-made wine. This is
1792.
So January 1788, Philip, you know, puts the flag up in Circular Quay. And by 1790, the first wine is
1792, the first wine's produced. So, and that's really kind of a mythological wine that a researcher called Don Seton Wilkinson, who actually comes from an old winemaking family, discovered this wine and followed a few correspondence, but it's incomplete. But it suggests that Governor Phillip, on his return, took some bottles of wine from Rose Hill, which was Parramatta, a Rose Hill dry red, and showed it to people in Germany, and there was some correspondence asking, is it true that he brought some bottles out? And so within the book that we have a thing called a canon of Australian wine, which it talks about all the major wines produced from 1792 to almost the present day. Mm-hmm. And they really tell the story. They also tell the story of Australian wine through the ages. But the vineyard at the Crescent was planted in 1788.
Where was it planted?
At the Crescent, which was really near Ryde. You know, there were quite a lot of little vineyards that were starting to pop up.
This, for everyone, the rest of Australia, is Ryde's a western suburb of Sydney.
That's right.
And so at that stage would have been entirely rural.
Yeah, that's right. Entirely rural. Everything was rural. Good old Annandale, which is in the west of Sydney, was rural. But in fact,
where did the grapes come from, though, Andrew? I mean, because did they bring cuttings with them?
They did. And I think that's actually one of the most fascinating parts of the story is vine stock transmission and how it came out. You know,
what did they bring?
Well, the story is that the received wisdom is that, you know, most of the vine stock was picked up from the Cape Colony, but through my, which is South Africa, but from my research, you know, there were vineyards that existed in England in the late 1700s, and one was known as Payne's Hill. And we know that Sir Joseph Banks and Daniel Solander, who was a protege of Carl Linnaeus, visited Payne's Hill. And it's highly likely that some cuttings were taken from vineyards in England and also from Kew Gardens in the earliest First Fleets. And this will explain why some of the earliest wines were made from Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. which were called small black cluster and black cluster. Mm-hmm. But there was, quite a lot of vine stock that came from the Cape Colony, South Africa. And one of those interesting ones is Semillon. There was a very famous nurseryman called Thomas Shepherd, who had a nursery at Darling Nurseries, which is actually almost right next door to where we are right now. And he was walking along at Piemont and found a very verdant and vigorous grapevine. And he took cuttings and he propagated them at his nursery and then sent them up to Irrawang and other places up in the Hunter. And this material was then known as Shepherd's Riesling. And then it became known as Hunter River Riesling. And then it was discovered that it's Semillon. And I think that that's really interesting. So, this kind of genetic material that's grown in the Hunter Valley can be traced all the way back to the very earliest days of settlement. And I think, and the same thing with Pinot Noir. So we have a very, very successful clone called MV6, which means Mother Vine 6, which was developed by the CSIRO in the 1970s, and it's planted widely in Victoria and is making some of the most beautiful Pinot Noir wines. And these cuttings were taken from Maurice O'Shea's vineyard at Mount Pleasant in the 1970s that had been originally planted in the 1920s by Maurice O'Shea. And these had been sourced from Kirkton, which was the property owned by the Busby family. Mm. And those vines were sourced from James Busby in 1832 from his journey around France and Spain collecting cuttings. And we know that those cuttings were picked up from Monsieur Ouvrard from the Clos Vergeot, which is a Grand Cru vineyard in Burgundy, who also happened to own the most famous vineyard in the world, Romani Conti, at the same time. So there's a huge amount of romance that goes around.
Yeah.
And behind that, for most people who are listening, they will say, well, so what? But it's the same thing as, kind of horse breeding or any of those kind of things.
So just pick on them. So those French cuttings that Busby collected, they in genetically still exist here.
Yes, they do.
And we'll get to phylloxera in a moment.
But
whereas that destroyed things in France, it didn't ever get here. Well, so those cuttings are actually still here.
The progeny of those cuttings are there, but it's the same genetic material because everything is cloned. You don't plant grapevines with seeds. So they're identical to the cuttings where they had beforehand. And we've got the largest acreage of surviving 19th and early 20th century vineyards in the world. Mm. And this is a pre-phylloxera genetic material that really sets up Australia's fine wine conversation and should be setting it up for the next 100 years at least.
Mm. Who was one of the, not myths you bust, but one of the things you correct in the book is that I think if people thought about this for a moment, they'd say, "Oh, the person who began the wine industry in Australia was James Busby," because, as you say, he went and collected cuttings and he planted things and got things going. And most people would say that. You say actually, no, it was really one of the MacArthurs.
Yeah, no.
Now these MacArthurs, I mean, you can make your own judgment about the MacArthurs, but old man MacArthur, was a blackguard.
No, they were a magnificent family, and even John MacArthur, I think, there's some stories
He's
about him.
He's got a lot of faults.
Andrew. He's got a lot of faults, but an extraordinary ambitious, extraordinarily ambitious man. But yes, James Busby is often referred to as being the father of the Australian wine industry. And in fairness, he did bring in this massive collection and deserves, kind of accolades for what he achieved. But he came in with, and he had a lot to do with the early colonial wine industry in New South Wales for a little while. But he went off to New Zealand and got involved as the first resident of New Zealand after he'd come back to Australia with his collection. And so it was really William MacArthur, who was the son of of John MacArthur of Merino wool fame, and who also was really important for the early wine industry. But it was William MacArthur. He might not have been the father, but he was the parent of the Australian wine industry.
So he got it going. I mean, your book, as you make it clear, he got it going.
He did, and he was...
Because Busby disappeared, didn't he? Busby.
Yeah, he disappeared. And well, he didn't disappear. He had a big career in New Zealand as the first resident, and he was involved in the Treaty of Waitangi. He was a very, very controversial figure and not liked by a lot of people as well. And he had a big, you know, kind of feeling of entitlement and believed that he was owed, you know, all this, you know, kind of great positions and stuff like that. And he even got into a fight in New Zealand. And anyway, his story is fascinating. But as far as Busby and Australian wine is concerned, it ends in 1832. It is William MacArthur and a whole lot of others that really get the wine industry going.
What about Elizabeth? Because after all, she had a key.
Yeah, well, she's
not given the credit she deserves.
No, but she was a very brave woman. I mean, she, you know, when John MacArthur was in London to account for his involvement in the Rum Rebellion, which took place in 1808. And by the way, it was known as the Rum Rebellion only recently, in recent times. It wasn't called the Rum Rebellion at the time. It was a coup d'etat. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And John,
no less.
And John MacArthur became the colonial secretary in this, you know, kind of government, unauthorized government. And you know, he had to go back to London to account for his behavior. And he, you know, but he really worked the system really well. I mean, he was very well connected in the UK. You know, through his previous life in the army, and he was really well connected in with the British aristocracy, particularly the Dukes of Northumberland that owned Sion House, and that's one of the reasons why Sion House was one of the source areas for Busby's collection. You know, the MacArthurs were incredibly well networked, and even John MacArthur was involved in the Royal Society of you know, Arts and Manufacturing. Manufacturers, which became known as the Royal Society. I mean, he was an incredibly powerful, ambitious man who achieved a hell of a lot. But his son William was a far more gentle human being, and really, you know, he was sending cuttings all around Australia into the new colonies in 1848, down to Port Phillip, down to the Yarra Valley. In 1829, he helped, as well as Blaxland, Gregory Blaxland, he sent cuttings over to the Swan River Colony. Mm-hmm. And that was 7 years before the foundation of South Australia. And of course, he sent a lot of cuttings down to South Australia as well.
Tell us about South Australia, because this... I mean, this is the most famous wine-producing area in Australia.
We're 2 minutes early for South Australia, aren't we?
Yeah. Actually, you're right. We'll wait for South Australia. Actually, yeah, you're actually quite right. Yeah. South Australian listeners will join us live in
2 minutes.
No, about 7 minutes. But let's talk about the Hunter Valley then. Why did the Hunter Valley become... New South Wales's prominent wine growing district?
Well, it was because that's where all the population was.
I mean, it's far away though at the time.
Yes, but you could reach it by...
When you say the population was there, not really.
Well, it was in the sense that it was the access into the Hunter Valley became easy with the advent of the steam age, and you know, the kind of steamships going up by packet boat from Sydney up to Newcastle and then up the Hunter River and all that kind of stuff.
But there was something revolutionized. But did they recognize already that there was something unique about the terroir, the land itself? Or was it just that it was available?
Well, no, they saw, you know, it was the Paterson River and the Hunter River, and they recognised that there was a real potential for agriculture. So it wasn't only wine, it wasn't only viticulture, it was also mixed farming and all of that kind of stuff. But the reason why, the major, you know, kind of classic wine regions of Australia are all close to Australia's capital cities is because they were servicing the population that were close to them. And, you know, it's the same thing with the Yarra Valley and you know, the Geelong area around Melbourne. And then, of course, around Adelaide, the Southern Vales and the Barossa Valley.
So who got started in the Hunter? Who were the earliest families up there?
Well, Busby's family. They had Kirkton. There was Irrawang, James King, Irrawang. The Wilkinsons. There were, and then
what were they making?
And then of course the Wyndhams. You know, George and John, at Dalwood. So you know they were making primarily. I mean, it was a cottage industry, but they were making primarily dry table wines. They were making some fortified wines, of course. But, you know, the ambition, you know, during the 19th century wasn't as a fortified wine producer. It was as a table wine producer. Mm.
Dry red table wines?
Yeah. Well, you were talking about earlier on about phylloxera and, you know, for the advent of phylloxera, which is an aphid-like pest that came in from the United States into Europe. And the reason why it came in and was so devastating was simply because of rapid transportation, you know, created by steamships. And, you know, so that these pests didn't actually die on the voyage. And so they landed up getting a stranglehold and destroying the vineyards of France. And it wasn't only phylloxera. There was also, you know, kind of oidium, which is a powdery mildew. And that was really a kind of a problem that was overcome fairly quickly, but phylloxera was a massive.
It was devastating.
Problem.
Was devastating in France. Yeah,
absolutely
wasn't it?
Huge.
It just yeah. it almost wiped. It almost wiped large parts of the wine industry out.
Yes, it did. I mean, production went down hugely, and of course that opened up possibilities for the Australian wine industry, particularly into the British Empire.
So we were exporting bottles from when? Early on, or?
Well, not bottles, I suppose.
We were exporting hogsheads, I suppose.
Well, we were, but bottles, yes, because if you're talking about, Gregory Blaxland, when he won the silver medal and the gold medal, was in the mid-1820s, and those were sent over by barrel. Uh-huh. But it seems to me that the 1792 wine that we were talked about was probably in bottle, hand-blown bottle. Mm. But the export market of ferruginous dry red wines from South Australia from the 1880s and 1890s was absolutely phenomenal. And we were exporting huge amounts of wine that were made from the Southern Vales, McLaren Vale, Barossa Valley, Clare Valley. And then a little bit later, really in the 1890s, starting to go and really early 1900s in Rutherglen and northeast Victoria. Yeah.
We're talking with Andrew Kayard. He's written a magisterial history of Australian wine called The Australian Ark. Why the word ark? What's so ark-like about the Australian wine industry?
Well, the reason why I called it that was because all the vine stock and all the people came in by boat. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the name for it. It's not an original title. Mm. There's another scientific book written about livestock coming in called The Australian Ark. But I always came back to it, and I really liked the title because it also suggested another thing, which is, you know, kind of a sprawling narrative. And of course, it's spelt slightly differently, but it sounds exactly the same phonetically. Hmm. And so I really liked that term. And then, of course, the Ark, everyone calls it the Ark now in the industry. And it has that kind of feeling that it's a reference, like it's a kind of, you know, a kind of Bible, if you like, of knowledge about Australia's, you know, wine industry. Mm.
Mm. In a sense, is there a little notion that because of phylloxera, that there are genetic strains of vine grapes in Australia that exist here and don't exist in France because of phylloxera?
Totally.
In other words.
Totally.
You know, we the great pestilence arrived, and these things survived here.
Totally, totally. And this is the story that's not really been told properly out there. Mm. You know, when I was much younger and being in London or going, you know, talking to masters of wine and, you know, kind of fairly authoritative people, they all talked about these wonderful wines from Bordeaux, pre-phylloxera wines that they were able to taste. And they were probably showing off more than anything else, you know, saying that the wines were much better. Yeah.
Exactly. Let's continue this conversation, but I do want to bring in others, including our listeners from South Australia, into this national conversation.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
This is Nightlife. We are talking wine history with Andrew Kayard, who's written a marvellous, marvellous history of Australian wine called The Australian Ark. It's in three volumes. It's the most sumptuous publication. And he's here in the studio with me. We're talking about wine regions. It's an appropriate time to talk about South Australia, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So why is South Australia, not uniquely, but most famously, Australia's greatest region for producing top quality Australian wines? Not necessarily the most. That's probably the Riverina.
No, it is the major producer of wine.
Is it just the terrain?
It's also history as well that taken place. I mean, Victoria got phycloxera in 1877. Well, it was formally recognised that it came in 1877. And so there were a lot of vineyards that were pulled up, particularly in the Geelong area. Mm-hmm. And phycloxera never arrived into to the Yarra Valley until more recent times. And it's never been in the Mornington Peninsula. But so there are large tracts of area of Victoria that haven't got phycloxera. Rutherglen got it in 1899, the same year as Rioja did in Spain. Mm-hmm. And that completely devastated the industry there. And they didn't really get back on their feet until about the 1920s. And in the meantime, in South Australia, the South Australian government were incredibly visionary. They were really the first to really put in these draconian quarantine laws that started in 1875. And that was really in response to the Ovidian outbreaks that took place. And they just gradually strengthened it until the 1899 Phylloxera Act. And that's the reason why, you know, there's so many surviving 19th century vineyards in South Australia. It is incredible. There is no other country in the world that has got so many old surviving vineyards of this. They're not the oldest. There are older vines in places like Chile that go back almost 300 years, which are surviving. Mm. But that's out of a variety called Pace, which is pretty obscure. But, you know, South Australia has got the oldest surviving Grenache vineyards in the world, the oldest surviving Cabernet Sauvignon vineyards in the world, and and the oldest surviving Shiraz vineyards in the world.
The oldest surviving. What do the French call it? Syrah, don't they?
They call it Syrah, and we call it Shiraz. And the reason why we call it Shiraz is it's a corruption of Syrah. People used to think it was that because it was called Shiraz, the great variety came from Persia, but that was rubbish. Mm. It's just purely phonetics that got us to the word Shiraz.
Is that right?
It's
just a mispronunciation of Syrah.
So there's another variety called Sauvignon, which was brought in by James Busby, and everyone called it Savannah. And then there was another variety called Tramina, not Gewürztraminer. And there was a very, very famous wine called Tremia. That was first released in the 1920s. But, this is the way that Australians, you know, they corrupt English pretty well and come up with new and exciting phrases.
If you've got questions, Andrew's here, he'll be here for another 20 minutes or so. So if you've got questions, ask him. He knows literally, I would think, everything about Australian wine.
Well, not everything.
I think you would. when you go to Italy, Andrew, one of the things that really strikes you almost immediately is there are hundreds of varieties of wine that you've never heard of.
Yeah, that's
You've never heard of.
Right? Yeah,
you think, oh. So yeah. The world is not just red and white, Cabernet Sauvignon and Shiraz and Semillon and Chardonnay. It's not.
No, it's not.
And so how do we end up with the varieties that we did?
Well, we did that to say it's just simply for historic reasons. If you just look at the first type of varieties that came in, it was from the Cape Colony, from the Canary Islands, mm-hmm. from Madeira. You know, of course, England was at war with France pretty much for the whole time during the Napoleonic era. So from really the early 1800s right up until the 1820s, so for 20 years. And so, you know, one of the things that happened you know, with Busby, was actually bringing all this new material coming in from France. But he also picked up cuttings from Spain. But what happened with that consignment, it was destroyed. And I often wonder, you know, what would have happened if the, some of those cuttings had survived. But even in those days, you know, Tempranillo was barely known about. And so it was really, it's for historic reasons and, you know, and, you know, kind of Britain's, you know, kind of influence and power, if you like. And of course, we also know that, you know, later on post-Napoleon, you know, there was quite a lot of interaction with Italy. But, and so we didn't really get many Italian varieties, but it is, you know, we often talk about vine stock like Sangiovese, you know, being an alternative grape variety. But it was actually brought in by a guy called Thomas Fiaschi, who was a very famous surgeon, a marvelous, absolutely marvelous man who also went to Gallipoli. And he had a vineyard called a Saint Augustine, which was you know, he was making wine out of Italian varieties in the 1890s. So but Italy is just mind-boggling in terms of the varieties, and I'm not an expert. I mean, I go into the classic areas like Barolo and Chianti and Puglia and Veneto, and I've had the great privilege of tasting lots of wines, but I can still tell you I'm not an expert in Italian wine.
No, I just might be beyond any human, actually.
There are people who know it.
You can't be good at everything. Australia is good if you're talking about the great Australian wines, Hunter Valley Semillon, South Australian Shiraz and Cabernet.
Yeah, particularly, yeah. I'm a great fan of Cabernet Sauvignon. I love that variety. Yeah.
Tasmania recently in sparklings. And I was going to ask you about it because you've mentioned it a few times, and also fortified wines, particularly in northeastern Victoria.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
With those things, well, I think that you know, what really kind of happened was there was an act that was put in place in 1924 called the Export Bounty Act, and it was instigated as a kind of reward to Australia for its war effort, and so it encouraged wine producers to produce fortified wines to compete against the cheap wines out of Portugal and Spain. And that's really how it all started. I mean, we were making, you know, some fortified wines beforehand, but that's when it really all got going, you know, in big time. And in a way, you know, I mean, the wines out of Rutherglen, you know, the famous Muscats and Tokays, well, now we have to call Topake, and the Muscadels, and, you know, they are really beautiful, but they're basically fortified grape juice, you know, which, so it's a very different type of style to, say, the tawny ports of vintage port styles that are made in South Australia, and also in Rutherglen make them too.
So let's return to South Australia. You say, would you say Cabernet Sauvignon is the great grape of Australia? See, many people would say no, Shiraz is.
Well, I think they both are, really, and for two completely different reasons. I mean, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon was brought in, in fact, by William MacArthur in 1837, because they realized that Busby's collection wasn't complete. So they brought in a whole lot of varieties, including Semillon, because at the time they didn't realize that that Thomas Shepherd's Riesling in the Hunter Valley was the same thing. And so they all believed, because claret was the kind of style of wine that everyone wanted to drink.
What was that?
Well, claret is from Bordeaux, and it was basically based on Cabernet Sauvignon.
Blended wine.
Primarily Cabernet Sauvignon.
Right.
But, you know, it didn't really take hold because it's a very difficult variety to grow. It's not as consistent. Shiraz has been more successful. But just quickly, Coonawarra, development of Coonawarra from 1819 onwards, you know, it was the first place in the whole of Australia where they actually prescribed the plantings, you know, of what grape varieties you put in. John Riddick.
Okay.
And so it was two-thirds Shiraz and one-third Cabernet Sauvignon. And, you know, of course, Coonawarra wasn't successful really until the 1960s and 1970s. And there was a complete pivot. And Coonawarra is much better known for Cabernet Sauvignon. It's a wonderful place to grow Cabernet Sauvignon. In fact, a guy called Hugh Johnson, a very famous wine writer, called it the kind of Medoc of the Southern Hemisphere. And then, of course, then there's Margaret River with Cabernet Sauvignon. And Margaret River has this wonderful clone called the Horton clone, which also can be traced back to the early colonial days. And it's just, you know, a magnificent kind of selection, and just works perfectly for the Margaret River.
What were winemakers trying to emulate the great wines of France, or were they just trying to do the best thing they could with what they had? And from out of that emerged that more robust, big-hearted Australian style, which we associate with now.
All of the above, really. I mean, it depends, on the individual stories. But there's no question that the climate, the climate of Australia, is warm, hot, good growing scene. The sugar accumulations in the grapes are fairly high, and so therefore you get a higher alcohol. It's not unknown to produce wines of 14.5% and 15% in this country. Mm. And in fact, there was a big scandal in London in the 1870s where a guy called Dr. Thudicombe was accusing Australian vignerons of manipulating their wine to get to these high alcohol levels. And Australian, kind of growers saying these, we get them naturally, and some of the scientists didn't believe it. And it was one of the things that hampered Australia's export markets. And of course, there were tariffs and customs and stuff that didn't help as well.
Is the wine industry a history of many individuals, or are there? There are often great individuals who steer a course, who change things, who make. I mean, people point to Max Schubert at Penfolds, for example, who produces the first Grange.
Yeah.
As marking a great turning point.
Yeah.
What's your take on those things?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. You know, this is the wonderful thing about the wine community, is this the extraordinary thinkers that we have. And, they come from all sorts of different places. Max Schubert was incredibly important, and most people will know about him because he's, kind of part of Australian lore beyond wine. But he was the inventor of Grange, and behind that he had a team of people like Dr. Ray Beckwith, who discovered the relationship between pH and wine stability. We won't go for any further than that, but I mean, for a general audience. But
explain what you mean by when you say invented Grange. What did he invent? He invented the blend?
Well, he invented a style of making wine.
Right.
And it's been mythologized a little bit. And through my research and stuff like that, I've kind of realized that actually a part of Max Schubert's genius is that he is really kind of integrated traditional winemaking philosophies and brought in a new ideas like barrel fermentation and aging in new American oak and all of that kind of stuff. So he really kind of synthesized a colonial viewpoint into a more postmodern way of making wine. And he created this, if you for want of a better description, he was really the inventor of modern wine. And a lot of Australians, really admired it, and some people have followed in his path, but others have gone down a different way. And there's another winemaker that some people may or may not know called Brian Crozer, established the Petaluma vineyard and now has that wonderful Tapanapa brand. I mean, he was really into protective winemaking and, kind of fruit purity and clarity and all of this kind of stuff. And he went down a different road. And he particularly, with making Chardonnay, for instance, kind of made a big name. And then you've got people like Wolf Blass, who was inspired by Schubert and the Penfolds way of making things, and by Cyril Henschke up there, and he came up with this way of making wine, and his big mantra was no wood, no good, and he became incredibly famous. But then we've got people in Western Australia like Vanya Cullen at Cullen Winery, developing biodynamics and organic. I mean, it is incredible, the tapestry of imagination that makes Australian wine.
One of the things about the French wine tradition is the fact that it's been always been made this way, and it's got long history, and they're very protective of it, the culture of it, the, you know, the nomenclature of it, etc. And a lot of it is so much marketing hoo-ha, in a sense, isn't it? Because they sneer at new, what they call New World wines.
Yeah, but no, it is true. But you know, the French were fighting about nomenclature way back, over 100 years. We were put on notice in 1916 in Paris, at a convention that took place that was really, you know, a discussion amongst the Allies about what the shape of the world would look like after the First World War. And one of the things was putting Australia on notice for the fact that we were calling our wines claret and burgundy and all of this kind of stuff. And you know, we took those things off our labels in the early 1980s, you know. So but yes, the French have changed completely. The new generation of people coming in are far more worldly, far less protective.
They don't care whether we call it champagne.
No, oh, they do about that, of course, because champagne is a place, not a style. And of course we called that, but just generally in terms of you know, the Australianness of our wines are very accepting of that, and they are very protective. But they've used innovations in their winemaking that come from the New World, you know, in terms of making their wines as much as we borrow from them.
Let's take a couple of calls. Peter from Hobart. G'day, Peter. Sorry, you've been waiting on there.
Not sure.
Yeah. Hi. What your question? Observation.
Hello, am I online?
Yes. You are, Pete. Yes, yeah, you're here.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for a very informative program.
Pleasure.
My great grandfather was Joseph Stein, and
I
was told that he and his brother
they worked for
the MacArthurs.
That's
and
right.
The first Rhine Riesling.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Is that right?
Yeah,
that
no, right? Okay. It is exactly.
I heard there's some conjecture about who bought out the first Rhine.
No, it is exactly right. They came from Markebrunner Vineyard in the Rheingau, and they belonged to a whole contingent of what they called vine dressers that were brought out by the MacArthur family, William and James MacArthur, in 1838. And it was a year after the importation of Cabernet Sauvignon. And they landed up, being part of that whole, you know, Camden Park, kind of vineyard, and were very, very important. And then some of the family landed up going up to Mudgee, and there are, you know, kind of members of the Stein family that are making wine there today. But they are a particularly prominent, if you like, kind of German family that were involved in early colonial winemaking.
Mm. Oh, thank you.
There you are, Peter.
The rumor was right then.
You are part of Vineyard.
Yeah, and you should be very proud of it too. Actually, they nearly didn't come. There was nearly a mutiny. To come to Australia in the 1830s was like almost coming, you know, going to the moon. If you were going to Australia, it was highly unlikely you'd come back. And so they when they got to London, they almost all said that they weren't going to go. And it was William MacArthur's brother, Edward, who later became a Lieutenant General, who managed to persuade them that they should go and that their lives would be much better in New South Wales.
Mm. Thanks, Peter.
I'm glad they did.
You are part of
that history.
Vine royalty, Peter.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Stephen from Greenwich, too. Stephen, hello.
Oh, hello. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yes, I'm just the comment that you just made about MacArthur and Camden Estate in the 1838. Frederick Seckold was one of the six vine dressers.
That's right.
That were brought out, and he is my about six generations back. My mother's family name was Seckold.
Wow, and it's fantastic, isn't it?
It's amazing, and I've seen the original contract that was written for each of the wine dressers, or vine dressers as they were.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible what they provided them with. Family, homes, the children went to school, they were housed on the estate. And as far as I know, some of the original families are actually buried on the original estate at Camden.
Yeah, that would be right. And it's really interesting because, you know, the whole theory behind, you know, kind of establishing wine estates was you know, the power of land theory, and it was all about, you know, if you planted a vineyard, you needed people to work on the vineyard. You've got people working on the vineyard. You needed a butcher. You need a candlestick maker. You needed all that kind of stuff. And so you would create a community and an economic bubble, if you like. And that was very much part of the post-revolutionary agricultural philosophy of the time.
Hmm. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Stephen. How much bigger could it get, the wine industry in Australia?
Well, I think it's going to contract.
Yeah.
Because
of climate.
Well, no, because we've had some, climate is part of it. Right. I mean, the irrigated, kind of winelands, winelands of Australia have been struggling quite a lot. Mm. I mean, if you remember the massive tariffs that the Chinese put onto Australian wine, you know, we were selling $1.2 billion worth of wine annually and annually into China, and it literally disappeared overnight. And so, of course, where does all that wine go? And we've got very large amounts of wine sloshing around in tanks, trying to find a market. And so, you know, the people who are mostly badly affected are the growers in the irrigated winelands. You know, the cost of production are going up, the prices are going down, and you just can't make a living out of it. Mm. So what I think will happen with the Australian wine industry is that we will go down a premiumization route. We will land up, we will still be making some commercial wine, but not nearly on the same scale as we used to. Mm. And we will land up, you know, having more of a focus on very high quality wine, which is, I think, is the way to go. And even if you think about it, you know, with the whole new trend of wellness and, you know, no alcoholic, you know, products and stuff like that, you know, it kind of makes sense that we go that way. Mm. Mm.
What do you think about the impacts of climate change? Already we've seen some premium wine makers buy land holdings in Tasmania because it's cooler down there and they think that's what's going to happen. Mm. Is that going to make a big impact on iconic places like South Australia?
Well, yes, but I think it's not all doom and gloom. I think it's also an exciting challenge, because what's happening is that the wine industry has become a lot more focused on sustainability and, you know, how to manage vineyards and to improve vine performance and, you know, new technologies using, you know, AI, you know, and new types of, you know, using kind of sunscreens on, you know, vines and everything like that. I think that the future for the Australian wine industry is really great, and I think that the biggest problem for the industry is not climate change right now, it's urbanization and the
taking up of land
and the rampant destruction of very, very valuable agricultural land, and, you know, all because of, you know, basically local politicians and property developers all being, you know, kind of, and then using the excuse of jobs. But in fact, what they're doing is they're destroying the future for future generations, in my view.
How big's your cellar?
Not very big, but big enough.
Steve Proserpine has texted in saying, "Phil, I've got 5 boxes of Rockford Basket Press Shiraz floating around the house. I'm blessed." Well, Steve, if they're floating around the house, I'd recommend you put them up on a shelf immediately.
The lovely wines are Rockford Basket Press wines.
It is delicious indeed. So the future, you would think, is smaller, more premium, and more expensive.
Well, yes, yes and no. I think there's some wines that we produce that are too cheap. Mm. You know, we're talking about this old vine story surviving. Mm. You know, this is incredible. This is more incredible than, you know, the wines that are coming out of France, some of the stuff. And we buy these wines for virtually nothing.
Wines like what?
Oh, well, you know, kind of old vine. It's labeled as old vine Barossa, old vine Shiraz, generally, is a good example. Mm. And you know, some of the old vine Grenache, you know, there's a very well-known wine called Cirillo, 1850 vines Grenache. I mean, that's the oldest surviving, you know, Grenache vineyard in the world.
It is incredible.
And you can pick it up for a little bit, but it's for nothing comparatively.
It is incredible. Look, read more. I would highly recommend this book. It's, as I say, it's a book about Australia. It's not just a book about Australian wine. Yeah. It's called The Australian Ark. It's a massive thing. It'll take you a while to get through, but it's a great reference thing to have at home as well. The Story of Australian Wine. The author is Andrew Kayard. He's a master of wine, renowned wine connoisseur, auctioneer, expert and writer as well. Andrew, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio.
Thank you.
Congratulations so much on the publication.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.